Was it tariffs on China or a full employment program for Vietnam? How about both? I'm Scott Ott with Bill Whittle and Stephen Green, and this episode of Right Angle is brought to you by the members at BillWhittle.com. Gentlemen, there were two pieces in the Wall Street Journal, one a news story and the other a column by Walter Russell Mead, talking about various aspects of how the United States deals with China. As you remember, in 2018-2019, the Trump administration imposed tariffs, generally about 25%, on a variety of industries, initially designed to do a couple of things, to punish China for their violation of intellectual property rights of U.S. manufactured goods, but also to drive some of the manufacturing business back to the United States. They called it onshoring at the time and now. And those tariffs have been in place for several years now, and they have taken some manufacturing operations out of China, but not really brought them to the United States. In fact, the chief beneficiary have been other Asian countries like Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, specifically Vietnam. Vietnam moved from its ranking of number 12 on the list of countries that export to the United States, or I guess the U.S. import business was number 12 on that list, and has moved up to number 6 in just 2-3 years since the tariffs took effect. But the article in the Wall Street Journal points out that it wasn't necessarily just the tariffs that drove that business out of there, but rather they accelerated a process that was already underway because China's wage pressure is going up and factory workers want more money. And so it's actually cheaper to manufacture in some of these other Asian countries. Stephen Green, Walter Russell Mead kind of piggybacks on that idea and basically says that if you want to defeat China, the real way to do it is not to try to crush China, but rather to promote Asia. It is a Vietnam full employment program, for want of a better term, my term, not his. Do you think that seems like a wise strategy?
It certainly worked in Europe, in Western Europe, after World War II. The Marshall Plan helped to rebuild Western Europe, made them strong enough to resist not just the Red Army on the other side of the Iron Curtain, with our help, of course, but to resist the temptations, as it seemed at the time, of communist rule. Yes, Walter Russell Mead is absolutely right on this one. I'll go a little further. China's history with their neighbors is fairly sordid. You know, that China is the middle kingdom around which these smaller countries kind of hovered, and various Chinese empires would demand and receive tribute from all of their neighbors. Sometimes that tribute was in the form of slaves, castrated males that would be fixed and sent to China to work, whether they were from Vietnam or Korea or wherever else. And they would demand money, slaves, whatever it was. And the Middle Kingdom, China, would receive these things. So right now, the situation in the Far East is you have two great powers, China and the United States. One of these great powers has a history of demanding tribute and has territorial ambitions on most of their neighbors. The other great power, the United States, has a history of rebuilding former conquered foes like Japan, helping allies like South Korea and the former South Vietnam, and exacts no tribute, none whatsoever, and in fact helps defend these places from the big country with the territorial ambition with our own soldiers, with our own airmen, with our own Navy. So as China rises, and I've been writing about this for a long time, as China rises, it is the natural tendency of its neighbors to look to the United States for trade, for security, to help resist this growing power in Beijing. But that requires something on our part. It's a natural tendency on Japan. It's a natural tendency on Korea. It's a natural tendency on Vietnam to look to us. But it isn't absolute. We have to be resolute, not by saying China's the bad guy, rattling sabers and all the rest, but by showing that we are firm and secure in our ambitions and in our treaty obligations to our friends in the middle, in the Far East. When we are not resolute, you get situations like the Philippines, which has been going back and forth, China, America, China, America. You start to wonder, where is South Korea going to look? Where will Japan look in the future? Obama did that pivot to Asia back in 2012 or whenever it was, but the cover was buried. He didn't actually pivot to Asia. And that's when this natural tendency started to fall apart. We got 4 years of good stuff out of Trump, not perfect, but definitely an improvement. And we saw the our alliances strengthening. As I look in the situation in the Middle East, and I did a segment on that this week. You should absolutely watch that. You should watch it twice. As we watch the situation deteriorating in the Middle East and the Biden administration vacillating and actively harming American interests in the Middle East, Tokyo will take notice. Seoul will take notice. Hanoi will take notice. Manila will take notice and wonder, should they accommodate themselves to China or should they take a risk on this vacillator in the White House?
Bill, Steve's pointed out something crucial here that echoes what Walter Russell Mead in the Wall Street Journal was saying, is that Republicans and Democrats alike tend to look at China as a growing dominant hegemon in the region, that they're basically, there are two superpowers in the world and China is one of them. They're going to get stronger. We're going to get weaker. It's just the trend of history and that's how it's going to go. But Walter Russell Mead tends to look at it more like pre-World War II Japan, where the leaders in that nation realized that they had a brief and fortuitous moment of industrial dominance that they enjoyed over everybody else in the region. And the war hawks, so to speak, in that regime pushed, as the Beijing war hawks are doing now, pushed to seize the moment because you can, and it's not going to come again. And so he's not seeing, Walter Russell Mead is not seeing this as inevitable Chinese dominance, but rather a fortuitous moment in time that's actually going to fade with Asia rising, with meaning the other Asian nations rising. Does that interpretation make sense to you?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I don't want to say I'm not worried about China. Obviously, I'm worried about China, but this business of China owning the future, I just don't believe it. I never did, and I see no indication that that's true. Matter of fact, I'm pretty convinced we're past peak China. But this analysis on part of Mr. Reed is spot on. Asia has a tendency towards hegemony. So for those of you unfamiliar with the term, hegemony is control, but it's not quite as strict as an empire. An empire has administrative control over other countries. Hegemony really is just kind of pushing your way around and getting what you want from other countries without actually having to administer them as an empire. And there was the Mongol hegemony and Chinese hegemony and so on. And what he's talking about here is that period of Japanese hegemony, which really started in the 20s and lasted until August 9th of 1945, where Japan had built up a very strong military, at least on paper. But they didn't have the industrial base to continue it, and they knew that the only chance they had would be to win a fast war. If they didn't get into a fast war, it was over for Japan, and all of them knew it. So now we see a situation where in 45, Japanese hegemony just disappears. The Greater East Asian co-prosperity sphere, gone. There's this enormous power vacuum into which sails the United States Pacific Fleet. So far, so good. In the intervening 70 years or so, our dominance, our lead over the rest of the countries in the world has lessened, not so much because we've dropped the ball as because we, in 1945, the rest of the world was at the Stone Age. You would expect that as Germany and Japan rebuild their economies, they're going to close the gap. And that's normal and appropriate. So you go from Japanese hegemony over the area. The United States moves in 45. We are clearly, especially with this administration, making it clear that we're not going to be there in the same capacity that we used to be. China is clearly anticipating to move into that space. They're building a blue water navy and doing their best to fill that role. So in answer to your original question, yes, the way you beat China is you take away the only thing China has, and that's money. And the reason they have money is because of their manufacturing base. Anything you can do like tariffs to make Chinese products more expensive means manufacturers go to Vietnam and all these other places you mentioned. That hurts China. They've got a one-child policy, which means they got a population crunch that's coming up. That's going to hurt China. They've got all of the ills of affluence that are on their way in terms of a young population that wants all these luxuries, doesn't really want to work very hard from all that's on its way. And I think the main thing to do is to do everything you can to economically move any businesses out of China to the other countries in the region, like Vietnam. But I think also comes a point when you have to realize, and I'm sure these governments realize it, that specifically Japan and South Korea are becoming more and more aware of the fact that they're going to have to provide for their own defense and maintain their own spheres of influence. And that means a nuclear defense And these people are our solid allies. Japan and South Korea, some of the best allies we have in the world. So all these things taken together does not lead me to believe that China is the future in any way, shape, or form. I am particularly pleased and melancholy about the fact that the great capitalist power that may actually take China down is going to be Vietnam. And if only these slow learners had picked up this lesson back in the 60s, we all could have avoided a whole lot of pain and mess. You know, it's as good an example as you could possibly find that that communism specifically and leftism in general has to be enforced by coercion. If you leave people alone, they want to build things, they want to trade things, they want to improve their lives, they want to own their own property. And it makes me exceedingly happy to see this. To me, it's an indication that despite all of the problems of Vietnam and all of the heartache that it cost us, we were in fact on the side of history on this one. And I never really doubted that.
Hey, Scott, can I throw in one last thing?
Yes.
Bill, believe it or not, China actually, Beijing ended the one-child policy a few years ago. There's a problem with that. After two-plus generations of this, they've normalized just having one kid. You got two, three generations of kids with no brothers or sisters, no aunts or uncles.
Right.
Grandparents who have two complete sets of grandparents with one grandkid. And even though they've relaxed the policy, people are still just having one baby. By the end of this century, it's expected that the United States will have more people than China does. About 450 million here, about 350 million there.
And when you have a country like China that has open access to not only encouragement, enforced abortion, if you're talking about a one China policy, and if you can only have one child, those children have selectively aborted little girls. Yeah. So you also have the societal stress coming up of a society that is way, way out of balance in terms of normal couples and all of the trouble that excess male population is going to create. So I'm not worried about them. I'm more worried about what we're doing to ourselves by far.
Bingo.
And recently released Chinese census figures within the last week or so have revealed that population boom has petered out and that China has exactly what Steve described, which is they've got a population problem because of the one-child policy and a number of other ways of approaching life that they've backed. This is the finish for Walter Russell Mead's column. He says, Asia's peoples and countries want to be independent and rich. Washington's job is to help the Asian dream come true. And what I love about this is that forever, as long as the United States of America has existed, we have been the hopes and dreams people. We have not been the people who threaten others and try to impose our will with military force until we're backed up against a wall. We are unnatural in the role of trying to bully other countries around, whether it's a superpower like China or smaller nations. We just don't like to do that. We do like to hold out the dream of a life of independence and accumulation of rights and property that can make for a happy society. And so when people from other countries like Vietnam or Indonesia or Malaysia or the Philippines look to the United States, that's still how they see us, no matter how our own intellectuals staring into their own navels have come to denigrate these United States of America. The American dream is alive and well and largely outside of the shores of this country. And so this was why this was such an exciting story to me. I mean, it's funny because we say, well, you know, we raised the tariffs and therefore companies moved their business to other Asian nations. That wasn't really why they did it. I mean, there were no tariffs on Samsung for their phones, but they moved their business out of China anyway. Number one manufacturer of smartphones in the world moves their business out of China, frankly, because capitalism works. They looked at the cost of labor in China and they said, you know, that's going up, but we can make things over here cheaper. And so they moved where their production facilities were, and that will continue to work. And so anytime you start getting worried about this gigantic Chinese tiger of a monster dominant hegemon in the region, you've got to fall back to first principles and say, really, how does the world work? Are they following the laws of God and nature's God and of physics and of how economies work? No. inevitably, their system cannot sustain itself because people can vote with their feet. And the only way you can keep a country like that going is if you can suckle at the teat of some capitalist nation, which is what China's been doing since at least, you know, Nixon opened up China, as they say. You have an opportunity here as the United States of America to be what Walter Russell Mead calls the linchpin of these Asian nations, to come together with them, to stand beside them, to make it clear to China that this is where growth is going to happen in the future. And if China wants to be an honest player in that market, great. But if China wants to continue down the path of authoritarianism and control and bullying people, that's just not going to work because there are more of us than there are of them. For Bill Whittle and Stephen Green, I'm Scott Ott. Thanks to the members at BillWhittle.com for making Right Angle possible.